Welcome to Sound Print. I'm Lisa Simeone. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Boy, does it ever! Shakespeare hit the nail on the head. Summer just never lasts long enough. The lazy afternoons, the song of the cicadas rising and falling, the last few glimmers of light being squeezed out of the day as night finally approaches. It's all so wonderful and so brief. So hats off to the people who work so hard to make it last, the ones who run the Ferris wheel, who serve the hot dogs on the boardwalk, who sweep and trim the baseball diamond to keep it gleaming. We all owe them our gratitude. So producers David Isay, Dan Collison, and Nina Ellis are going to take us on a journey to meet some of these summer people. Today's program is called Summer Triptych.
Coney Island Chamber of Commerce. No, Steeplechase Park closed in 1964. Thank you very much. Welcome to marvelous Coney Island. My name is Matthew Kennedy. I have been with the Chamber of Commerce here since 1924.
Out of a tiny second-story office on Surf Avenue, 86-year-old Matt Kennedy has run the Coney Island Chamber of Commerce by himself for decades. It's not a fancy operation. There's a desk, a file cabinet, an old Royal Manual typewriter. On the walls hang a few ancient Coney Island photos, which shake, along with the rest of the office, each time another subway train rumbles by on the elevated tracks just outside his window.
Coney Island Chamber of Commerce.
During the summer months, the chamber's rotary phone rings off the hook. Today, most of the calls come from nostalgic retirees down in Florida, just checking in on old Coney Island. Matt Kennedy, a cigar perpetually clenched between his fingers, fields each call happily.
People call and they want to know the temperature of the water. I ask them to wait a moment and I'll go down and see. And then I go out and take a whiz and come back and tell them 60 degrees or 70 or 68, whatever number comes to mind. And they seem to be satisfied and thank me. Yes? Of course Coney Island still exists. Right, it's bigger and better than ever. Thank you very much.
Matt Kennedy has made it his mission to let the world know that there's a lot more to Coney Island than meets the eye.
Right across the street from my office stands a cyclone roller coaster, which opened in 1927. It's the largest, fastest, and most thrilling ride in the world. The Cyclone is a monument comparable only to the Eiffel Tower.
Each morning, as dawn starts to break over a sleeping Coney Island, Walter Williams, the caretaker of the Cyclone roller coaster, begins his day of work. Slowly but skillfully, he starts to climb the first steep hill of the cyclone, tapping every inch of steel track with a hammer to check for loose nuts and screws, eyeing the creaky structure for rotting wood.
These two screws here, see, they loose.
The daily three-hour journey up and down and around the mile of cyclone track might seem like a lot for this gray-haired 53-year-old, but Walter Williams doesn't seem to mind.
I take care of her. I see after her, I fix her, and I make sure she's okay. I love the Cyclone. I like you, will love your wife.
The Cyclone is the last working roller coaster on Coney Island, where the world's first roller coaster, the Thompson Switchback Railway, was built in 1884. The Cyclone is still considered, by those who know these things, to be the greatest in the world. Each day at noon, the padlock gates to the Cyclone are swung open, and anxious customers stream in to board the roller coaster's three ancient cars. An old sign exhorts them to hold on to their wigs as a pot-bellied tattooed attendant locks them in for the ride of their lives. Moments later, the brakes are released and a chain hauls the cars, groaning and creaking ever so achingly slowly up an enormous hill. At the top, for that brief instant, the world freezes, the heart stops, as the view of that terrifying, straight down, endless drop comes into focus. Then it happens. From there on in, the ride, propelled only now by gravity, doesn't slow for an instant.
The ride is about a minute and 40 seconds of fun, of natural fun.
Walter Williams spends most of his afternoons leaning back against his tool shed at the center of the cyclone, watching as the cars fly by.
Sometime when people get off the roller coaster, they throw up, or they be shaking, and sometimes they just fall, like there's something hit them that day, like they die. They just lay there with their eyes closed. It's a hell of a ride to be on.
It's a ride with history. There was Charles Lindbergh, who soon after his solo flight across the Atlantic rode the cyclone and called it the thrill of his life. Then there was the Army private left mute by battle trauma during World War II. He was unable to speak for 5 years until, after taking a ride on this roller coaster, he stood up weak-kneed and uttered his first words, "I feel sick." And even though the decrepit cyclone may seem to bend and strain and shudder through each screeching ride it gives, even though it may look like it's got one leg in roller coaster heaven, if you bother to ask Walter Williams, the roller coaster man, he'll tell you that he knows better.
The cyclone will stand forever as long as it has someone to take care of it the way that I do.
You're my Coney Island.
Coney Island has always meant sweets. Everything from the Eskimo pie to saltwater taffy was invented here. There were once a dozen candy stores operating up and down Safe Avenue. Today, the only one remaining here is Coney Island's first, Phillips Candy.
Right down the block from Matt Kennedy and the Chamber of Commerce, in the ramshackle old Coney Island subway terminal, stands an unlikely sight, a tiny walk-up shop freshly painted in red and white stripes.
All right, who's next? Who's next? Fresh made. We got them.
The store showcase windows are piled high with caramel apples and coconut patties, walnut maple fudge, and huge swirled lollipops on sticks as large as baseball bats. This is Phillips Candy.
Nice and fresh, still warm. Here we go.
Behind the counter stands an unshaven gray-haired man in a perpetually stained white jacket. John Dorman, who owns the store, has worked here since 1947.
There are some candy shops that make fudge.
Yes?
Or they make chocolates. Or they make taffies. But this candy shop makes everything, and we make it from scratch.
You want yours in a bag?
And if you stand on tiptoes and peer over the antique cash register and around the jars and trays of candy, you can almost make out where it all happens. Cramped into the back room at Phillips is an entire candy factory run day and night by Dorman and his small staff. It's hot, and the sickeningly sweet smell is overpowering. A worker sticks an enormous wooden spoon into a cast-iron cauldron filled with something sticky and blue. Right next to her, a rotating belt-driven contraption pours out a never-ending stream of popcorn. Cotton candy hangs on a crisscross of clotheslines overhead as the wheels and gears of a fire truck red taffy machine spit out 145 pieces a minute.
This is the place for good stuff. The best. Come here, we gotta make you happy. If we don't make you happy, we'll keep working on you till we find something that will make you happy. You're not gonna leave Phillips Candies until you are happy.
Hey, honey, meet me at 8 o'clock down by the river dock, and we'll hop that Coney Island boat.
Paddles are turning and water are churning, and we're off to Coney, to razzle-dazzle Coney.
Just across the street from Phillips Candy stands the original Nathan's Famous hot dog stand. I remember well that historic day in 1916 when Nathan Hanwerker and his wife Ida opened Nathan's. Today, thanks to them, the hot dog is an American tradition.
I know that way.
There have always been two ways to buy a Frank at Nathan's Famous hot dog stand. Most people line up at the long chrome counters on Surf Avenue and pick up a dog to go.
Three Franks, please.
Let's give me a Frank for the
But if you're looking for a more personal touch, you can venture down the narrow alley to the side of the stand through two swinging doors into Nathan's Famous dining room.
Ready, folks, or would you rather look at the menu?
There you're in safe hands.
My name is Sol Seidelman.
My name is Sol Gaber.
We've been working as waiters for Nathan's for the past 40 years.
Sol and Sol, gray-haired and paunched in matching yellow and black Nathan's uniforms, work the day shift in the dining room as they have for decades.
When people come in, they think of Sol and Sol are brothers. It's just like a husband and wife after being married many years that they start to look like each other, and the same thing with us.
The dining room is small and drab and hot. There are a dozen tables and a single booth, which Sol and Sol reserve for lovebirds. Round portholes filled with yellow-tinted plastic serve as windows.
You come in, you're comfortable. Nothing special here. We don't decorate the place for you.
You feel at home when you come to Nathan's dining room. You feel at home more than if you go to what do you call a beautiful, a place. And that's the whole thing.
Sol, can you pick up 16 francs for me, please? Two orders of French fries and four Cokes.
Okay, Sol. 16 francs, four orders of French fries.
The franc was invented on Coney Island in 1896 by an immigrant from Frankfurt, Germany named Alfred Feltman, who owned the great Feltman's Restaurant. One of his employees was an enterprising young bun slicer named Nathan Hanwerker, who knew a good thing when he saw one. Hanwerker quit Feltman's, borrowed $300, opened up this stand, and called his product the hot dog. It caught on, and Nathan's became an American institution.
You'd be amazed that some of the biggest movie stars that you think they go to the finest restaurant, and yet they wind up at Nathan's eating the hot dog.
I've served personally Marilyn Monroe, Doris Day, Edward G. Robinson.
I wish I never in my life that Sol would meet people like that.
And while people like that may no longer be coming to Nathan's dining room, Sol and Sol still have their hands full with customers.
How do you do, ladies?
You want a Frank? I don't know.
The routine is simple. Sol and Sol sit their patrons down at a table, point to the large menu hanging on the wall, and take the order.
Ma'am, listen to me. It comes out cheaper for you. It's a special, honestly. I want to explain.
After getting everything straight, Sol, or Sol, heads to the back of the kitchen where that order is announced into an ancient squawk box attached to the wall.
Attention, please. Attention. Give me 14 francs, four orders of French fries with cheese.
Then, in a flash, it's back to the table, a tray of piping hot dogs in hand.
There's nothing like Nathan's Franks. It's 100% beef. I mean entirely 100% beef. In other words, there's no mixture in there. And the taste of the Frank is really, it's very hard to describe. But it's so delicious.
We serve a skin hot dog, which is much better than a skinless hot dog. So when you eat the hot dog, it actually cracks in your mouth.
A lot's changed since Sol and Sol started working here in the early 1950s. The price of a hot dog has gone up from a nickel to $1.75. The lines for the dining room, which used to snake around the block on Saturdays and Sundays, have disappeared, as have the mobsters and politicians and stars. And now, at 72, the older of the two Sols, Sol Gaber, is finally ready to turn in his apron and retire.
You know, the funny thing about the whole thing is that all I am here is a waiter. And yet I'm proud. I'm proud of the fact that I work here. And of course, when I retire, I certainly will miss it. And I'm going to miss Sol.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Hope you call again.
Well, I certainly hope you enjoyed your visit to Coney Island. If you're ever close by, stop in and see us. We'll be here.
And for Soundprint, I'm David Isay.
That was about 15 years ago. Coney Island has had a major facelift since then, but you can still form sweet memories of summer there. One place that no longer offers that option is Memorial Stadium in Baltimore. It's been torn down. The new ballpark is Oriole Park at Camden Yards. But before the old stadium bit the dust, Dan Collison had a chance to hang out with one of the most important guys in baseball.
Baltimore Memorial Stadium. It's one of those warm summer evenings that makes you forget there's a world beyond the green field and grandstands. The setting sun casts long shadows out into right field. There's an easy rhythm to the pregame rituals, players tossing the ball lazily to each other, ushers showing fans to their seats, vendors hawking beer, peanuts, souvenirs. And in a cramped locker room deep beneath the stadium, Ernie Tyler is rubbing up baseballs.
Okay, the first thing you do is you take a little bit of the mud, put it on your hands, and then you put a little bit on the ball. There, 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 there. It's four spots. You just take it, go around real good.
Ernie Tyler has been performing this pregame ritual for more than three decades now. Before every Orioles home game, he makes sure that 60 brand new baseballs are rubbed up with a special silky fine mud from the Delaware River. The mud takes the shine off the ball and gives the pitcher a better grip. Ernie has done this to more than 100,000 baseballs since he became the Orioles ball boy. His official title is field attendant.
I like baseballs, and it doesn't matter what they call me, as long as they let me stay there.
Ernie loves baseball and his job so much, he hasn't missed a game since he started back in 1960, even before he retired from his regular job with the state health department. That's more than 2,500 straight games. It's just moments before tonight's game. The Orioles are playing the Kansas City Royals. Ernie's been here at the stadium for about 4 hours now, making sure the umpires have everything they need, clean uniforms, tickets for their friends. Over the years, he's become sort of an umpire's assistant, and he walks out onto the field with the men in blue. Ernie is dressed in black from head to toe, an Orioles cap on his graying head, and he carries two canvas bags. One of them has the 60 baseballs inside. The other is empty. The damaged balls will go in there. As the players take the field, Ernie takes his seat in a folding chair behind home plate in front of the first row of fans. It might seem like a dangerous perch, but Ernie says he's never been hurt in all the years he sat there. The closest call was a foul tip that just nicked him.
Came right between my right arm and my right rib, and it just sort of zapped in between it, and it dented the fence, but it didn't dent me too badly.
The most important part of Ernie's job is to make sure the home plate umpire always has a fresh supply of baseballs. Ernie keeps track of the foul balls that go into the stands, and when there's a break in the action, he'll go out and replenish the supply. If a foul ball goes back up onto the screen behind home plate, Ernie sprints out, rather spryly for a man who appears to be in his 60s, he won't tell, and waits for it to come down.
Good catch, Ernie.
I used to catch them while they were in the air, and one time I missed five in a row. That was back in 66, and Billy Hunter said, well, he was a coach at the time, he said, well, why would you want to catch them before they come off? I said, it's just a challenge. He says, well, stop embarrassing us. We were on national TV. So I just let him bounce now.
Another part of Ernie's job, and it's the part he likes best, is to act as a liaison between the umpires and the press box. He'll clarify controversial calls or confusing plays. Here, the Orioles catcher and third baseman have let an easy pop-up fall into foul territory near home plate. It's unclear who should have caught it. Someone in the press box wants to know who called for the ball so they can decide who gets blamed for the error. Ernie goes out between innings and checks with the umpire. Then he phones back.
The pitcher called Gomez on the play, so Melvin backed off. All right, now you know. Is this Rick? Oh, hi, Bob.
Ernie has a kindly, weathered face, leathery from all those day games. He's friendly with the fans who sit behind him. He knows most of them, and over the years, he's seen them come and go.
Mr. and Mrs. Jacobs, they died. Mr. and Mrs. Berman, Mrs. Berman moved to Florida. Mr. Berman died. Their kids have the seats.
Hey, Ernie. You could tell that thing was gone as soon as he hit that
ball. Yeah, hanging
curveball. He just hung that thing, and he just smacked the hell out of it. That thing is gone.
31 years of watching Orioles games has made Ernie Tyler a sagely grandfather figure to the fans, answering questions, providing analysis. And the question that's asked the most of Ernie Tyler, by far, is, can I have a baseball?
You see this cute little girl on the left-hand side now? She's about to ask for a ball.
Sure enough, a few moments later, the girl, actually it's a little boy, gets up the nerve to ask. Ernie politely refuses.
You start with 60 balls. If you toss one ball, what happens when you toss 60 balls? There's no baseball game that day. So you can't do that.
It's the bottom of the ninth inning now, and Ernie's bag of baseballs is nearly empty.
We used 44 so far. Plus the five he's got, four he's got in his pocket. There goes one.
A few more pitches, and the game is over. The Orioles lose 6-4. Ernie folds up his chair, grabs the remaining baseballs, and heads for the locker room. There, he'll make sure the umpire's luggage gets to Cleveland, and then go home, his streak intact.
So this was what, game 2,515?
Terrible game, we lost again. But anyway, I'll be here Monday to see what happens. And we got Minnesota there like 14 out of the last 16. But it's the game rather than the team that I like to watch.
All right, Ernie.
See you
later.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Baltimore Orioles field attendant, Ernie Tyler. I'm Dan Collison.
We thank you all for coming, and we hope to have the pleasure of seeing you again soon here at Baltimore Memorial Stadium. Thank you.
The Orioles have moved to a new ballpark since Dan Collison talked to Ernie Tyler at Memorial Stadium. But of course, baseball is as much a part of summer as ever. Another perennial part of summer is the state fair, or in some parts of the country, the county fair, where, more than anyone, farmers get to strut their stuff. Producer Nina Ellis visited one such fair in Virginia.
Okay, everybody that's got a cart and a wagon that you are going to do in the obstacle course and you're hitched up, we're going to go ahead and start. It will be a point system with a time for a tiebreaker.
You ready?
Yeah.
All right. Front.
In the old days on the farm, what you did for fun wasn't much different from what you did for work. In Southern Virginia, hundreds of people are here for the Blue Ridge Draft Horse and Mule Show. These people know something about farming the old way, with horses and mules. The men and their animals cross over a creek and gather in a pasture, waiting their turns to compete in a plowing contest.
I come up here especially to see the plow. And my wife said she didn't see what I'd want to come way up here to see plowing. Much as I done walk behind the plow. I've walked behind it long time. I see, I came along back down when the Depression was. When, by God, you had two biscuits for breakfast and you had to save one for supper. So, by God, I come along when times were tight.
The huge horses and mules stand in companionable pairs. Dolly and Travis are placid Belgians, golden tan with blonde manes. Their rumps are beautifully round. Tom and Frank are Percherons. They're all black and tall. Their ancestors served in Napoleon's armies. Jack and Pearl are draft mules. They're huge, too, and perfectly matched with long ears. Their father's a donkey, their mother a Percheron.
All right, class number 33, walk and plow single hitch. In this contest, the horses and mules will be asked to plow four furrows, two going down, two coming back.
This plowing contest turns out to be funny, even though the competitors are serious, because most of them aren't very good. They go too fast, their rows are crooked, the animals don't listen, and the men give the wrong commands. These horses are a hobby. But Grady Thornburg has done this for a living. He's 74 years old, and he's got a good mule named Mindy.
And after running number 58, Jeff. So we're looking for Mindy. Take him home with Katie.
This scene is somewhere in the back of your mind. The mule leans forward into a round leather collar, which is attached to lines pulling a plow. The plow has a metal blade with a point that tears into the ground. The dirt peels up and off to one side, creating a furrow about 8 inches wide. The man walks behind in the furrow with his hands on the plow handles, the reins around his neck. Grady and Mindy are used to plowing a straight furrow. Today, they do it for a $25 first prize. At one time, they did it to survive.
All right, let's hear it from Mindy. This is a pretty plow there. Very nice. Up next, we've got number 37.
All day long, there's a lot of joshing and reminiscing in the crowd. Men too old to work with horses love to see it done well. This is Robert Myers from 7 Mile Ford in Smith County, Virginia.
Yeah, I've had horses ever since I was about 9 years old when you give me the first.
And didn't you ever get tempted to get a tractor?
Never did.
Why? Why is that?
I don't know. I reckon I just fell in love with the horses and I never did. I got laughed at a whole lot for keeping the horses, but that didn't change. I still like the horses. Mm-hmm.
For Soundprint, I'm Nina Ellis.
Summer Triptych is a Soundprint classic. It was produced by David Isay, Dan Collison, and Nina Ellis, with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. If you missed part of the show, or if you'd like to hear it again, you can by visiting us online at soundprint.org. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. If you have questions or comments for us, or if you'd like us to tell you about upcoming shows, you can email us. The address is talkback@soundprint.org. CDs of Soundprint can be purchased for a small fee by calling 1-888-38-TAPES. That's 1-888-38-TAPES. Or you can order online at soundprint.org. Next time on Soundprint, people with severe disfigurements share their struggles with self-image and their paths to self-belief.
Sometimes they ask me silly questions that, like, I've answered thousands and thousands of times with other kids. And I'm like, all right, do you get the picture? I'm different, but it's okay. I'm a human being here. And you get tired of, you know, having to answer all those silly questions that you know that you've done thousands of times with other kids. And
what are the questions you get asked the most?
Well, what's that stuff on your face?
These stories next week on Soundprint. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbro. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.